Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 330 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first part of a two-part interview, Kate Worsley speaks with Bethan Roberts about the substantial retraining she took when switching from journalism to fiction writing, the research joy to be found in both disciplines, the problem of imposter syndrome, and the value of a good mentor.
Kate Worsley's first novel, She Rises, a transgressive seafaring adventure set in 1740s Harwich, was published by Bloomsbury UK and US in 2013. It was awarded the HWA Debut Crown and the New Angle Prize for Literature and was shortlisted for a Lambda Literary Award in the US. Kate spent many years as a journalist, editor and sub-editor on national and specialist newspapers and magazines such as The Independent, The Guardian and the THES. Between 2014 and 2017, she was RLF Writing Fellow at Essex University and since 2015 has been a visiting lecturer in creative writing at City University of London. She is also an independent manuscript assessor and a mentor for the Escalator Talent Development Scheme. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Bethan.
Hello. It's very nice to see you come to Brighton to see me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I thought we could talk first, if you don't mind, about that transition between journalism and fiction writing. Because were you doing the two concurrently, or was there a kind of moment where you thought, no, I'm going to leave that behind, I'm going to do this instead?
I found that I couldn't do both. I think for years and years, all I did want to do was journalism, actually. And if I ever had an idea for anything, it died in a ditch along the way. I somehow couldn't manage to do both. My head couldn't be in both places at once. So I only actually started writing fiction when the magazine I was editing was shut down.
Right.
And I had a bit of redundancy money. And then I could let myself, give myself license or whatever, to go off and do the other completely undeveloped bit of writing. There was something about journalism, that writing for the market, writing reality, writing, you know, researched, bash it out, deadline stuff that was completely antithetical to the way, for me, writing fiction seemed to happen. So yeah, I had to switch off one before I could even think about doing the other.
So you weren't kind of dabbling at all? you knew you wanted to do it, but you didn't go there?
I think I was always told I should do it, which made me quite perversely decide to do something else instead. And I only dabbled in as much as, I don't know, go on holiday somewhere, have an idea, write it on a beer mat, and then it would be dead by the time I got home. Really nothing. I think I wrote a short story once that equally perversely won a prize in a Penelope Fitzgerald judged competition, which you think would have been encouraging, wouldn't you?
Yes.
But for some reason that completely stopped me writing never.
Why?
I don't know. I think I thought it had been too easy, which is deeply perverse, isn't it?
Right.
I just knocked off this short story. It had been received well, and
yeah,
and I decided not to carry on. Very, very weird.
Yeah. And so also, when was that? How old were you?
Oh, God, that was a long time before I even had a novel-sized idea.
Yeah.
That was probably in my 20s, and yeah, completely, you know, knocked around during my 20s.
And Penelope Fitzgerald said, this is great.
You would think that would
and you said,
be encouraging.
No way am I going to do that then.
I took the money and then I just didn't write anything else. I think also I wasn't very interested in short stories.
Okay.
I never really, I don't think I am a short story writer at all. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think, maybe, probably, thinking about it now, it never occurred to me that I could write a novel, because what would I have to write about and, you know, how skillful and hard would that be to do? So, yeah, I had a little bit of that.
So you had to put journalism in a different room, as it were, in order to move into your fiction room.
Yeah, really odd.
So what was that transition like? Because I know you moved from London to the coast, didn't you, to Essex? Did it?
Yes, I think it was all part of that. As well? Yes, so we did a very sort of long and slow transition. So we didn't move. We sort of gradually ended up living there. But I remember from the very first time we sort of had the key of the place on the first day, the feeling of being there on the coast of Essex, sort of about as, you know, as far as you can go without falling into the sea, feeling that it felt like being a teenager again. I felt invisible. I felt like I could wander around and, you know, do what I liked. And it was liberating. It was really odd. Whereas we moved from London, whereas I'd never felt like I'd had that in London. So I could go back to a more private, secret, inner, noodling around world. It was a lot to do with that. And so when I started writing fiction, I ridiculously thought, okay, I've got this redundancy money, I'll do a course. So I went back and did a course at Birkbeck, an evening class at Birkbeck, where I could guarantee that I wouldn't know anyone. I didn't tell anyone I was doing it, because for me it felt like I was starting again at the bottom. I felt like I'd done journalism, I knew how to do it. I'd gone from having to spend 3 weeks to write and research a 1,000 word article to be able to do it in a morning. And whereas fiction, I was completely overwhelmed and didn't know where to start. I mean, I'd done an English degree, I'd, you know, read an awful lot of books, but in terms of actually being able to do it, that was key for me, that feeling of, I don't know where to start, I can start at the very beginning, I can be really, really crap at this, as long as nobody else sees it. So I did this evening, you know, start to write evening class at Birkbeck with this chain-smoking woman who'd say, you know, write for 20 minutes about your bus journey here. She'd go off and have a fag and she'd come back in and set us another assignment, you know, which was terrifying, completely and utterly terrifying to do that. But I needed that, because I knew that's where the journalism overlaps into the writing. I need deadlines. I need someone from outside to say, do this, and then I'll do something else, probably, in fiction terms anyway, but need that starting point. Yeah.
So it was terrifying because you were having to read stuff out, or just the whole thing was terrifying?
It was terrifying to dare to not just go from external sources and to not concoct something from the outside world, to dare to just see what came and risk there being nothing, or what comes being really awful. So once I'd resigned myself to that I could be crap, then that really helped.
And it was okay to expose yourself in some way, do you think?
Yeah, as long as no one else saw it. Expose myself to myself, which sounds awful, doesn't it? But that's what I was doing.
But there is a weird thing, isn't there, when you're writing a novel, where you do feel like it's only you that's ever going to read it. And because readers read in private, you are sort of exposing yourself to yourself, aren't you?
I know, it's like whispering through a crack in the wall to the outside world. It's really strange thing to do. I know. So why on earth would you want to publish it? But then you do. And then that is the brilliant thing about meeting readers, because exactly, you're right, they've read it in the privacy of their own room. It's not a public performance in any way, is it? You know, secret messages going out to the outside world. I know, it's very odd.
And hoping someone will read your message in a bottle.
Yeah, it's message in a bottle, exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah. So you must have had things, though, that you learned from journalism. I mean, you said about the deadline thing. Do you think there was anything else that helped you?
Yeah, two main things. So deadlines, absolutely need them. Research, I loved doing research for journalism. And I'll do research till the cows come home on anything. But the brilliant thing about research for fiction is that it's a starting point, not an ending point. So it took me a few years of researching. I researched She Rises 4 years. I mean, you know.
Did you?
To bits.
Yeah.
And I met a historian called Richard Woodman, who lived in Harwich, who knew all about the Merchant Navy, not the Royal Navy, but the Merchant Navy. And he was really useful to talk to, because basically I'd end up ringing him up saying, can this ship sail to this island within a week or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, I don't know. I mean, there's no documentary evidence for that, but possibly, you know. So that became my sort of point. Was it feasible? Is it conceivable? Yeah. Is it, you know...
God, that's so useful.
You can't footnote it, but, you know, you can't disprove it either.
So you had someone you could literally ring up and say, can I put this? And he would say yes or no, and then you would have the permission to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, which the journalist bit of me felt like I needed. Yeah, he'd written a book, a multi-volume book on the Merchant Navy. And he was super helpful. He was brilliant. So there's that research side of it. And also I hadn't anticipated that with the joy of fiction and research for me now is that it just sets you off. It's just like puts a rocket under you, and the gaps, the, you know, the bits that provoke your imagination, which were the really frustrating bits of journalism, because you couldn't fill those bits in, you know, not if you're being responsible, even in, you know, feature journalism, let alone proper investigative journalism.
Mm.
They're the bits that are just the bits that feed your imagination. So there was that, and then there was also the most useful thing, especially because I had this thing about I was really starting at the bottom and working up in terms of skills, that whatever you produced was just copy, and everything was always a first draft and could always be, as soon as you'd sort of extruded it, it was there to be played with and edited and messed around. And it's much better to have material on the table to work from rather than expecting to produce some perfectly formed sentence or concept or whatever.
So you didn't really have that crippling perfectionism thing?
Not at that end of the process. No. I have it at the other end.
Yeah.
But yes, so that's... But and then it is a problem in terms of I just produce lots of material, and there's a point where you can have too much research, too much material.
So that whole process, because you felt like you were starting from the bottom, you went to Birkbeck and you did some other creative writing courses as well, didn't you? Do you want to tell us a bit about those?
At Birkbeck I did start creative writing, and then UEA did these brilliant, some form of outreach classes in Ipswich called Carry On Writing, and then it wasn't called Carry On Writing, but it was, and then it was like,
it sounds like a movie.
I know.
Sick James.
It was great, and this sort of run-down further education building that was falling apart around our ears, and then a bit more carrying on, you know, to the point where I had a really brilliant tutor called Sarah Bauer who said, you know, you keep on going, you just keep going up to the point where you get the credits to do an MA and you apply for an MA. And at that point I had the novel-sized idea for She Rises, so that had appeared while I was doing those courses. So that was maybe a year of trudging through little sort of handholds up to feeling more competent. I had massive imposter syndrome, if you know, that's what you call it now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think looking back, that's absolutely what it was. And it was also because I had a family, I needed to justify to myself that this was, you know, time that I had carved out to do this, that it wouldn't just disappear in the cracks.
Yeah, I mean, courses can make it feel official, can't they?
That's cute. Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But and it also helped get over that this is private, hidden, secret, scribbling away in my bedroom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad I did it that way around, because it meant that when stuff finally did go public, it wasn't such a massive psychic shock, which sounds really precious, but, you know, it felt to me like there was no point writing fiction unless I was really being as unmediated as I could be.
And going back to that imposter syndrome thing,
yeah.
You know, I find that slightly surprising, because you had been such a successful journalist, really, and, you know, you'd already had a lot of things published, and you'd studied English at university.
Yes, I know.
So I'm just wondering where that came from, do you think?
I'm sure it's two things. So it comes from childhood and background, and just not ever feeling like it was a valid, you know, stand up in public, not utterly self-indulgent and pointless thing to do. Yeah.
Do you come from a very practical family? Is that what it is?
Yeah, well, I mean, my grandfather wrote plays in dialect
okay.
for his local amateur dramatic society,
yeah.
but, you know, it was always a bit of fun. You would never, ever, ever take yourself seriously in that sort of way. No, it'd, you know, pretentious bollocks. You know.
Right, yeah.
There's a, the area of endeavour that's pretentious bollocks is quite big.
Yeah.
It was partly that, and also partly because it's, you know, journalism's different. Journalism's completely different. Good fiction is amazing, isn't it? You know, and the bar, it felt like to me like the bar was set really high. And that was the thing. I would accept that when I started, that I could always aim for that, but I didn't have to start out like that. And I may never attain that, but that was fine, because as long as I was getting better. It's crazy.
So in terms of She Rises, then, when did that start coming to you? Was that one the... Did you have that in mind when you started the course at
No, I didn't have an idea of anything that I wanted to write. I just wanted to learn to get good at this thing that I found really scary, but seemed really important to do, to try to do, finally, to not put off any longer. No, it just came, and it came from living where I live. It's a little village that's also a centuries-ancient port where they used to build ships. And Harwich, which is just along the coast, was this massive shipbuilding naval centre. The Harwich Felixstowe Shotley Harbour is the biggest harbour on the east coast. It was strategically massively important, so it has a huge history. But you go there now, the Navy pulled out in the 70s, 80s. Absolute ghost town, real proper British coastal deprivation area. And it was to do with that feeling of all that history sitting there in a very mundane way next to the out-of-town shopping centre.
Yeah.
And this push-pull that there is on that bit of coast between the sea and the land. So because it's Essex and it's got a huge, complicated coastline, not really any cliffs, the sea and the land merge in this strange way. And where the village that I live in is on an estuary, so the tide comes up and it goes in and out the whole time. It's this sort of push-pull feeling. And I just got really obsessed with this idea of all the centuries that people had lived there. They sort of lived the other way around to us. We were on the coast looking out at the sea, whereas most people would move around on the water and come, you know, onto the land. Yeah, it came from being in this place and meeting people who had real roots there. And then also, just as I was starting to come up with the idea, the Harwich Shanty Festival started up.
Uh-huh.
The inaugural Harwich Shanty Festival, whatever year that was.
Right.
When Harwich finally, you could see what it had been like. The pubs were full of drunken men with huge array of beards belting out amazing songs, you know, into the night. And,
yeah,
you know, the streets would be echoing and singing coming across the water from the boats. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
I got really caught up in the romance of the high seas. Yeah, it was that.
Well, that's great. Because I think you were mentored by Sarah Waters, is that right? Was that, had you said you've got some of the novel down before that, or did those two things coincide?
No, that happened. I got onto the MA at City, where you could ask for a tutor. So I'd written maybe 30,000 of the novel before I got on the MA, but I'd written it as a Smollett pastiche. I'd written it in entirely 18th century language.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Gone to town. And that was a sort of way of tricking myself into writing. I thought, if I can nail this, not vernacular, but this, you know, this way of writing, then I don't ever have to think about developing my own style, because I've just sort of channeled someone else's. And I did love it. I loved the freedom and the verbosity and the
randomness. Oh, so it's like randomness. That thing you do when you're at school where they go, write the missing chapter of Cold Comfort Farm or whatever. Love doing that.
Yeah, just, you know, take this and run with it.
Yes, yeah. And start, that's lovely, isn't
it? Starting point, and then see where it goes.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about your own voice because you're doing it in somebody else's.
Yeah.
But in a way, you are doing it in your voice, aren't you? Because it's coming from you.
Exactly, and your themes and your interests and stuff are coming up. So Sarah Waters came about because you could ask for a mentor. And to be honest, I'd asked for Hilary Mantel, who was one of the course advisors or whatever.
Okay.
And she couldn't do it. Helen Dunmore, she couldn't do it. Someone else had asked for Sarah Waters, because I thought Sarah Waters was too close to this sort of thing I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Someone else got Sarah Waters, but then she left the course, so I got Sarah Waters. And it was the first time she'd ever apparently mentored someone, and she was amazing. She was just the best thing that could have happened, mm. actually. It was difficult in terms of, you know, later with in publishing terms with people saying, how is it different from Sarah Waters? And I'd say, really? Well, it's clearly different in many, many really obvious ways,
yeah,
you know.
How annoying. Yeah.
But she was great because she was absolutely focused on what the reader would want at every point.
Mm-hmm.
So she worked in a very sort of intuitive, responsive, not a tick box creative writing toolkit approach. It was just, does it work?
Yeah.
And she completely got the amorphous way that my writing brain seems to work, as in it just, you know, forms. It starts to form organically.
Yeah. I think that is the great thing, isn't it, about having a mentor?
Yes.
Is that they can just respond to exactly what your novel is or what it wants to be.
A good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. A good one who isn't,
say, the tick box.
Yeah, and someone who isn't trying to impose their idea of what your novel should be.
Mm-hmm.
She was fabulous, and she gave me massive confidence. She went way beyond the call of duty and what she needed to do, you know, in terms of her contract. So eternally
grateful.
I'm
very glad to hear all that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, isn't she a great writer, and isn't it nice that she's also a lovely person?
I know, because they, you know, you never meet your heroes.
No.
I know.
So then, to sort of talk a bit about how the first novel was published. You finished it when you were still working with Sarah, did you?
Well, this is the perfectionist, that we were talking before about the perfectionism. When I finished the course, it wasn't really anywhere near done, and it took another 6 to 9 months to finish it properly. Shall I tell you the publishing, the birthing story?
Go on, tell us. I think these stories are always interesting for people
to
hear, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Because they're all different,
and
they're all agonising in their own way.
Tell us how She Rises came into being.
So She Rises, the story of the She Rises birth is that it was lucky and agonising at the same time, because I did finish it to send out for publication, sent it to Sarah Waters' agent, turned it down, sent it to someone else who was supposedly interested, didn't like books about ships, so it wasn't going to work.
Uh-huh.
And then the agent I have now had expressed interest right at the beginning, had said I'd like to see it, and somehow I hadn't registered that. And then when I find, and then each time it had been rejected.
Fitzgerald moment.
It's a bit ridiculous, isn't it?
That was too easy.
Push that one away. Just forget that. Oh my God.
You didn't earn that.
Didn't earn it, no.
Yeah.
No, it came on a plate.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But anyway.
Yes, so then I did. So I sent it to her after having revised it, you know, again and again and again.
Yeah.
And then it was really fast. Then it was like, send her 30,000 words. Please send me the whole thing. Great, I love it. I'll take you on. I'll send it out within the week to everybody. And she sent it out to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 6 to 8 weeks, everybody had said no, except for one publisher who said yes, but they wanted it to be a different sort of story entirely.
Oh.
And at that point, I was chewing off my arm enough to go, okay,
yeah,
I'll completely rewrite it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But then Bloomsbury came back and said they hadn't been able to stop thinking about it, and was it still available, and they'd find the budget.
They came back. Wow.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. I've never heard that one before. That's a new one on me.
No. So at the time, I mean, when you don't know how it works, you don't quite realise that. So.
No.
And I was really lucky. Because then, Veronique, my agent, hadn't touched it. The Helen Gardens Williams, my editor, wanted a bit of tinkering. But then it did go straight out, which was what I had wanted to get from the going on lots of courses and doing lots of drafts version. They're getting it, you know, box fresh, ready to go stage. Yeah.
Mm.
I was sort of glad I'd done all that myself, because you do only have one chance, don't you?
Well, I'm still processing that thing that they changed their mind.
Well, they said they didn't have the budget the first time around,
and
they did.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was Kate Worsley in conversation with Bethan Roberts. You can find out more about Kate on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 330, which was recorded by Bethan Roberts and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 331, in the concluding part of this interview, Kate speaks with Bethan about historical vernacular, learning about writing through sailing, and how a novel became a trilogy. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.